Okay. All right, how's it going? All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 241, April 14th, last day before spring break, unless you have classes on Friday. Do you have classes on Friday? Would you like to have classes on Friday? Okay, yeah. Okay, so we're going to make some progress on this last chapter for the test, which is chapter 13. Okay, blood, heart, and circulation. Don't know if we'll get through it today, but we'll try. But there was a question. Yeah. Metabolism. You can see me after class. Okay. All right, so our test is still going to be right after spring break, but not on Tuesday. It's going to be on Thursday, right? So Thursday after spring break. This chapter is long, so don't put off your studying till Sunday, of the last Sunday in spring break. Okay, so probably, hopefully, you all are on top of things. All right, so we were talking about antigens and antibodies last time, and we drew a number of cells on the board. And so here we have a nice red blood cell, and it has this kind of antigen. Remember, antigens are always located on the cell surface membrane right there, cell membrane. What would be the blood type of this person? Yeah, because the type of antigen you have determines your blood type. And how many blood types are there? Yeah, there are four. So there's AB, and then O. That's right. Don't forget O, which doesn't have any antigen on the cell surface. All right, so there's another component of blood besides formed elements. What's besides formed elements, what do we have in blood that makes up whole blood? Plasma, right? So you got formed elements, which this guy belongs to, and then plasma. And in plasma, you have a number of things that are dissolved in plasma, like the gases and nutrients and proteins. And there's one kind of protein that we're interested in with this reaction that we're talking about, and that is an antibody. All right, and the antibodies kind of look like this. They kind of look like a little guy, all right, with his arms standing up, and then there are some receptor sites at the end of these arms. Maybe in micro you really get into the structure of these antibodies, maybe, I'm not quite sure. All right, and so these are receptors. They have to match up in shape to the shape of the antigen. So this is an antibody. All right, so that's an antibody. And now you're going to tell me which kind of antibody it is. But you can't write at the moment because I haven't filled it in. So here is the receptor site. All right, is that an anti-A, an anti-B, anti-C, or anti-O? What kind of antibody is that? And where do you find this thing? It's an anti-A because it's complementary in shape to the antigen right here. Right, do you see that? So this antibody receptor site can fit right over the A right here. Now, in real life, of course, it's not a perfect A like that, but there's some kind of shape to it. And here's another free arm right here. What can that bind to? That can bind to another red blood cell if it has an A antigen on it. All right, so here is the antibody, and we can see now an antibody will glue these two cells together in that kind of reaction. So this will make a transfusion reaction if we transfuse blood into the wrong people from inappropriate donors. This reaction is what we call agglutination. All right, this is agglutination. And it just doesn't happen between two cells, but it will happen between millions of cells. And that will cause blood to precipitate. And when blood cells are agglutinated with these antibodies right here, all right, so here's that receptor site, then these red blood cells will lyse, they'll explode, releasing all of that hemoglobin, and it has to be then taken care of with the liver. All right, so when you have blood type A, can you have any antibodies for A in your blood? No, you should not have any, because that's going to cause what? An agglutination reaction. All right, agglutination, sorry, I kind of misspelled it right there. Agglutination. So let's look at the four blood types and where do we find antigens and antibodies in these four different blood types. So make a little chart. So we have on the top about These are the blood types. What do we got? We've got A, we've got B, AB, and then blood type O. Come on, ink. Let's go. Keep working for me. All right, so antigens. Okay, and then antibodies. Oh, that's better. Antibodies. So here is going to be our little table right here, and we're just going to write down how these things match up. So as a matter of fact, where do you have antigens? Plasma membrane. I'm just going to put PM right here. Right? Plasma membrane. And for antibodies, where are these located? Yeah, plasma. Outside of the cell, plasma. Right in the fluid part of blood. All right, so let's fill in this table right here. So person with blood type A, what kind of antigens are they going to have? Anybody? A. They're going to have antigens A. All right, and automatically this person is going to produce antibodies, but not to their own cells, but to other cells that have antigen Bs on them. So the person with blood type A automatically will have anti-B in their blood. And when we say anti-B, that is just an antibody for what antigen? The B-shaped antigen. Right? It's not exactly the B-shape, but it's going to be something different than A. All right, so blood type B has what kind of antigens? The B antigens on the cell surface, and automatically this person produces what in their blood? Anti-A, right? Anti-A, just automatically. They don't have to be pre-sensitized. That just happens with them. And then here's a person with both A and B antigens on the cell surface. Now, what kind of antibodies do they make for the ABO system anyway? None. They can't have any, right? So no antibodies. No antibodies right here. All right. And then lastly, here we have a person with no antigens on the cell surface. And so this person here, what kind of antibodies can they make? They can make both A and B. As a matter of fact, they do make both A and B. So both anti-A and B. And so when I say anti-A, what do I really mean? Antibody, right? Antibody A, which is that little guy with these two receptors on it that can link red blood cells together. And the slide, oh, let me turn these lights down. So these slides right here. All right, just basically go over this little table. But on a test, if you need to draw that little table out so that it makes sense to you, all right, or if it makes sense just by memorizing this little list right here, that is fine. So this is just for this one antigen antibody system. There are many antibody antigen systems in your blood, all right, but this is the first one that was worked out. Okay, so here is another nice little diagram that shows what an antibody looks like, and here are the receptor sites. It just has to match up with the particular antigens by shape. They have to be complementary in shape. And this process where red blood cells get joined together with an antibody, we call that agglutination. We're going to look at some other kinds of blood processes that kind of look like agglutination, but it's not. What kind of reaction is agglutination? If you were going to classify that reaction that forms, that takes red blood cells and clumps them all together like this. All right, so here's an example of what process? Okay, that is agglutination, and agglutination is what kind of process? What's happening? What kind of reaction is it? That's what I wanted to ask. What kind of reaction is agglutination? What kind of molecules are interacting with each other? What are the two kinds of molecules that are interacting with each other for agglutination? Oh, let's go back to, this little square right here. Looks good. What do you need for agglutination to take place? You need an antigen. Fantastic. What else do you need? Can you just have antigens? No, you also need an antibody, right? So agglutination is an antibody-antigen reaction. Right, so it has to do with your immune response. Agglutination is an antibody-antigen reaction because you have antibodies in plasma and you have antigens on the cell surface right here. Okay, it just so happens, you know, this is so rare that we would actually transfuse somebody without doing blood typing and a cross match. So I'm not really so interested in this, but from a, I guess, physiologic standpoint, I suppose it's possible to transfuse blood into somebody that doesn't have a perfect match, but that would never really happen in a hospital. Okay, but blood type O is called the universal donor because it lacks the A and B antigens. All right, so somebody with blood type A can donate blood to anybody else of any of the blood groups. Blood type A, B is what we call the universal recipient because they don't make anti-A or anti-B. So that won't agglutinate the donor's red blood cells. All right, but this is just one antibody antigen system. There are many, so when somebody does blood typing and a cross match, they don't just look at the ABO system, they look at a whole range of antibody antigen reactions that could possibly happen before you transfuse somebody. Okay? All right, and here is another example of another kind of antibody antigen system that is important, and this is the Rh factor system. And Rh is a little bit simpler, actually it's a whole lot simpler. For instance, maybe I'm going to try to go to a black marker right here. Maybe that blue is not showing up so well. Here we have a red blood cell. And what kind of blood type does this person have? B. All right, that's with the ABO system. All right, but there is another system. Well, there are many, but here is another one. For this particular person, okay, now let's consider this person right here. This person has a B antigen. But it also they also have an Rh antigen on the cell surface. Rh is not part of the ABO system. It's a part of the Rh system. And either you have it or you don't. So the nomenclature is a little bit different. If you have this antigen on the cell surface of your red blood cells, then we say you are Rh positive. And if, for instance, if this is your red blood cell right here, okay, so this would be blood type B positive because positive refers to having the antigen on the cell surface right there. Now, who can tell me what the blood type of this person is in terms of the ABO and Rh together? This would be O what? O negative because this person doesn't have any antigens in terms of the ABO system and the Rh system. So this would be O negative. But we could turn this into an O positive by doing what? Sticking an Rh antigen on the cell surface just like that. And then that person's blood would be what? O positive. Right? So either they have it or they don't. Okay, now this system is a little bit different because it does cause problems sometimes. Rh negative, wow, I better put that cord away. Somebody that is Rh negative, like there, that's an Rh negative, just so happens to be an O. Somebody that's Rh negative does not automatically make anti-Rh in their blood. Right? And that is the antibody for that Rh antigen on the cell surface. They have to be sensitized. Somehow that antigen has to be introduced into their body and then they become sensitized and they start to make the Rh antigen. So this causes problems sometimes when people have a baby. What kinds of people? Well, if the mom is Rh negative, right, so the mom doesn't have any Rh antigens on their cell surface, right, but what can an Rh negative person make if they're sensitized? They can make an anti-Rh, right? They can make an Rh antibody, and it's not going to affect them, and it makes perfect sense maybe that they should have that, but it just so happens they don't automatically make it. So if the mom is Rh negative and the dad is Rh positive, this means that their offspring have a 50-50 chance of either being positive or negative, right? All right, so let's talk about a problem that could develop, and that is, if they have a baby that is Rh positive, so they got the trait from the dad, and of course this baby is in utero, it's inside of a person that is Rh negative, and if the mom is sensitized to this Rh factor, the mom is going to make what? Anti-Rh, and it just so happens that that anti-Rh factor can cross the placenta and can attack the red blood cells of the fetus, thereby destroying them. So that's a problem, because remember, all those red blood cells have, what, millions and millions or maybe even a billion red blood cells, we mentioned that last time, that the baby's body has to detoxify, right? That hemoglobin has to be broken down, and the liver is functional, but in babies, livers aren't exactly mature. So biliverdin, bilirubin has a tendency to build up inside a baby's body. And bilirubin is very toxic to a developing nervous system. And when they're born with a lot of bilirubin in their body, so they're born with what kind of color to them? A very bright yellow color. And so then they're jaundiced as a result of that. So if there is this mismatch, if the dad is positive and the mom is negative, then the baby could develop erythroblastosis fetalis, or what we call hemolytic disease of the newborn. Yeah, well, I don't have hemolytic disease of the newborn right here, but write it down on your slide. Okay, and that's because the baby is just losing way too many red blood cells for the baby's liver to handle all of that bilirubin. Right, and that is toxic to their nervous system. So it used to be when you got married, you always had a blood test to find out if the dad was positive and the mom was negative, and you would be aware of this situation ahead of time. And now with good prenatal care, that's no longer a prerequisite to get a marriage license, right? If you have prenatal care, you'd know that way ahead of time. And it can be prevented. For instance, the mother can get shots to take care of those antibodies that are built up in her body so it doesn't attack the fetal circulation. Okay, so who's got a question about that? I went over that maybe just a little bit fast, but, okay, so what would that be? How would that develop? If the baby has what kind of red blood cells? So if the mom is like this, right, negative, but what does the baby have to look like? The baby has to have a red blood cell with what? The Rh antigen on the cell surface. And if the mom is presensitized maybe with a previous pregnancy with a fetus that is Rh positive, then the mom will start to make Rh antibodies. If it's the first pregnancy, it's usually no big deal, but they're still treated anyway because the consequences can be so severe. But if it's a second pregnancy of an Rh positive baby, then the mom needs the shots, the Rogam shots, to decrease the activity of her immune system against the fetal Rh positive cells. And if that isn't treated, what does that produce? What's the disease process that produces? The observable sign is jaundice, but we call that what? Erythroblastosis fetalis, or hemolytic disease of the newborn. Okay. All right, so that's with the ABO and Rh system. So what kind of reaction is that? Erythroblastosis is what kind of reaction? It's causing agglutination of the fetal red blood cells, and agglutination is what kind of process? Antibody-antigen reaction. Those are the molecules that are working right there. Okay. Oh, I was going to say, I know why I was thinking. Now, how come you have an antibody-antigen reaction like this if it's an Rh antigen, but why is it, for instance, if maybe the mom is blood type O and the dad is blood type AB, and the baby turns out to be blood type AB, how come that doesn't cause an agglutination problem? Because, so the mom makes anti-A and anti-B automatically. And if the baby has A and B on the cell surface, how come that doesn't cause a problem like for the Rh factor? And the answer is because these antibodies right here don't go through the placenta. Okay? Some people say they're too big or they just don't have the right shape, so it doesn't cause the same kind of problem. But the anti-Rh antibodies can go across the placenta. All right, it's kind of interesting why that hasn't been selected out just yet. Okay, hemostasis. Let's go on to another topic, and that is hemostasis. And hemostasis is an important function of blood, like you probably memorized the whole list of functions for blood. But since blood is a fluid connective tissue, when you damage a blood vessel, it's just going to run or squirt right out of your body. So blood has to have some process to heal those wounds rapidly so that you don't bleed to death, so you don't hemorrhage to death, right? So cessation of bleeding is very important when a blood vessel is damaged. And there are two kinds of processes that we're going to be interested in. One is called platelet plug formation for small injuries to blood vessels, probably microscopic, at the level of microscopic tears. And the other is fibrin formation. This is important for large tears in blood vessels. Okay, and fibrin formation is what we call coagulation. And is coagulation the same thing as agglutination? You know what? Two different words, two totally different things going on, so I want to make sure that you're really familiar with these two different things that are happening in blood. They might sound similar, but not really. Agglutination is the clumping of red blood cells together due to an antibody antigen reaction. All right, let's look at a platelet plug formation first. So here we have a nice normal blood vessel, and this could be a capillary or other kind of blood vessel, but nonetheless, every blood vessel has an endothelium, right? It's just a simple squamous epithelium that lines the blood vessel, and if it's a capillary, that's all there is, right? It doesn't have a muscular tunic or other connective tissue tunics. And underneath the endothelium is a layer of connective tissue, and so you have collagen in this connective tissue. You have some other factors in this layer, like the von Willebrand factor, which we're going to talk about. Okay, and collagen and this von Willebrand factor do not have access to the blood when it's a normal blood vessel, right? It's underneath the endothelium. And this endothelium has some important jobs. It secretes prostacyclin, PGI2, and it secretes nitric oxide. And it also has a little protein right here, a CD39 protein that breaks down ADP into AMP, because ADP we're going to look at and see that's an important signaling molecule for platelets. All right, and although these look like red blood cells right here, maybe think of these as platelets. Okay, think of these things as platelets, which is what? What part of blood is a platelet? It's a formed element, right? Just like a white blood cell and red blood cell, but a little bit different function. All right, so nitric oxide and prostacyclin are vasodilators, and they also inhibit the platelet activation process, which can form a plug in a part of this blood vessel right here. So these things keep the blood flowing very nice and smoothly and prevent clots from happening and even small plugs when platelets like to get together. All right, now if there's damage to this blood vessel, this endothelium is destroyed and it reveals this collagen. So the blood plasma and blood cells can bump into collagen right here. And it can also bump into these little von Willebrand factor molecules, which is on the next slide. All right, when that happens, all right, these platelets, so it looks like a red blood cell, but that's really platelet, they become activated and they start to release adenosine diphosphate and another compound called thromboxane A2. Sometimes we call it thromboplastin. All right, and so then that attracts platelets to this the site of injury right here, and platelets then stick together and release more ADP. Okay, and then that forms a plug over this tear. And collagen helps promote this reaction, and this von Willebrand factor here helps promote this reaction. And ADP and serotonin released from these platelets cause the platelets to join together, but it also causes contraction of smooth muscle, and it causes a contraction of a blood vessel, thereby reducing blood flow over this area, which then further reduces the amount of blood loss in this area. So these are vasoactive compounds, but they also cause these platelets to stick together and kind of seal over this wound. But that only happens, right, when there is injury to the endothelium, when the collagen is exposed. And this TaxA2 molecule is a prostaglandin molecule, and some of you might know that you can actually take aspirin as a way to decrease clotting function, right? If you have problems with blood clots or other things that you can take, like coumarin and heparin, maybe you have thought of, but some people take aspirin, maybe just a little baby aspirin every day to help protect their heart, because aspirin blocks the synthesis of prostaglandins, pretty much all prostaglandins all over your body, okay, including this taxa 2 molecule, which then decreases the activity of the platelet plug formation in blood vessels, keeping blood flowing over, all right, this site right here. But what could be a consequence of somebody taking too much aspirin? Well, if they ever damage a blood vessel, you won't have normal blood clotting function, and so you'll have a tendency to bleed as a result of that, right? So you can't go overboard with that. Or it might be really contraindicated in some people altogether. Okay, so this is platelet plug formation for what kind of injury? At the microscopic or cellular level, right? But it happens when the von Willebrand factor is exposed and when collagen is exposed. And then that CD39 molecule doesn't work, so ADP can build up, and that's going to enhance the platelet plug formation right here. Okay, and so, yeah, I think we're done talking about that. Let's talk about the role of fibrin. This is the second process. This is for large injuries to blood vessels. All right, so platelet plug, okay, certainly does happen when you have a large injury, but it's not strong enough to heal a blood vessel or to seal a large tear off, so a person will still bleed. Okay, so a platelet plug certainly forms, but then there is another protein called fibrin that infiltrates that platelet plug, and this fibrin forms a network or a mesh like a net, and as blood leaks through that net, it traps more platelets, it traps white blood cells and red blood cells, and then it forms a clot. All right, so fibrin formation is how blood clots really form. So fibrin is the molecule that actually builds up inside the body. So I might come back to this slide in a little bit, but it's a synopsis. What I would prefer to do is just look at this scheme right here. And this is an exam figure for you. You don't have to be able to draw every step right here, but let's go over it. So this process of fibrin formation, okay, when fibrin forms, it's a protein that precipitates out of the blood. It's no longer soluble in blood, and it forms a net or a mesh. And maybe on the next slide I have actually what it looks like. No, I don't. Maybe next slide. Ah, here it is. So all these yellow molecules right here all joined together are fibrin molecules that are interlaced and form a network, and you can see red blood cells here, but it's also going to be what? Platelets and white blood cells and everything else. This is what is forming a clot. All right, so fibrin formation is what we call, the process we call that is coagulation. So now you know a nice molecular distinction between agglutination and coagulation. What is agglutination? What are the molecules there that are undergoing a reaction? Antibody-antigen reaction, but coagulation is what? Fibrin formation. Fibrin formation, that's when a molecule of fibrin precipitates out. And last time I think we talked about sometimes your body makes very important active molecules in an inactive form so that they can be activated very rapidly. And that inactive molecule, which is the precursor to fibrin, is fibrinogen, right? So if you have that ogen suffix at the end of the word, what does that mean? Ready to go to work, but it's in reserve, right? It has to be converted, okay? All right, so coagulation is fibrin formation. That comes from the activation of fibrinogen, which you have a ton of in your body. And where does that come from? Basically the liver. I think we mentioned that, right? That's one of the basic kinds of proteins that you have in blood that make up the plasma part of blood. All right, so here are three steps that make fibrin. Okay, you have prothrombin activator formation. This is the first step. The second thing is thrombin formation. And then the third step is the actual formation of fibrin in the blood. All right, and when you break a blood vessel, do you think this should be a rapid system or a system that can take its time in happening? Probably rapid, otherwise you could hemorrhage to death, right? Okay, so let's look and see if coagulation actually can happen in a rapid fashion and maybe why it doesn't in some cases. All right, so we have an extrinsic pathway and an intrinsic pathway. These both contribute factors into a common pathway which eventually will lead to fibrin formation. This extrinsic pathway is how blood usually clots inside of your body. Okay, the intrinsic pathway happens when we take blood out of somebody and put it in a glass vial or a test tube or something. All right, and so I'll describe a few of the essential saline features of these systems. Well, if you wanted something to happen fast in your body, what kind of scheme have you learned before that will do that? Like maybe a signal transduction scheme that takes a signal from outside the body and develops some kind of control signal inside of the cell because that molecule can't get through the cell membrane. How about if I say something like cascade, does that ring a bell? Okay, maybe, maybe not. A cascade is what? A set of enzymatic reactions, one after the other. And once an enzyme catalyzes a reaction, you activate an enzyme and then it catalyzes a reaction, does that enzyme get used up? No, it stays active. So it can catalyze that reaction, what? Over and over and over again. So when you activate an enzyme, that's like a level of amplification in that system. So one signaling molecule can produce many thousands or tens of thousands of molecules as a result of that enzymatic reaction. And then if that activates another enzymatic reaction, now you have a couple enzymatic reactions in series with each other, that's a cascade. So now you have thousands of signaling molecules producing what? Hundreds of thousands of other molecules, right? So that's something that produces levels of amplification and also speed. There's something else that will speed a process up if there is feedback involved. What kind of reaction might you guess, what kind of feedback mechanism speeds up a reaction instead of slows it down? Positive feedback, right? So in the scheme right here, I want you to look for a cascade mechanisms, enzymes that don't become deactivated, and positive feedback, not necessarily negative feedback, but positive feedback. All right, so let's start with this extrinsic pathway right here. You have tissue thromboplastin, okay? This is the activator for this system right here. And this becomes available when a blood vessel is damaged. So the connective tissue underlying the endothelium is revealed to blood platelets. Then we have an activator for this factor 7 that becomes activated, right? And then it's going to work on a molecule in your blood that we call factor 10. And factor 10, the real name for factor 10 is prothrombin. So prothrombin can become activated when factor 7 becomes available, and that becomes like an enzyme. All right, there are some other things that are necessary. Proper levels of calcium have to be in the blood. So coagulation function will be decreased if you don't have the proper level of calcium. So you might want to consider what process is more important, having good blood clotting function or super strong bones. That's kind of maybe a toss-up for some people, okay? But if you work in an environment where you lacerate yourself all the time or cut yourself or maybe, you know, break a bone or something, you'd probably rather have good clotting function than strong bones because you can die due to hemorrhage pretty rapidly. And phospholipids have to be in the right concentration and freely available. But why is that usually not such a big problem? Where do these phospholipids come from? Cell membrane. Phospholipid is a basic building block of a cell membrane so that when you rip a cell apart, like that endothelium of a blood vessel, then there are plenty of phospholipids there. That is a signal that does what? That starts the coagulation process. So that makes perfect sense that a damaged membrane or pieces of damaged membrane, right, will accelerate coagulation or what? Fibrin formation to heal that, to stop that blood loss. All right, so this is the first part right here. Prothrombin becomes activated. Now here's another word. Whenever you see a word with a prefix with PRO in front of it, that also means that it's a precursor molecule. It's just that for some reason somebody didn't say Ogen, they just named it prothrombin, right? I think we talked about proenzymes and prohormones before. So prothrombin is in your blood, it's built in high concentrations, but it is inactivated, but it can be converted into an active form very rapidly, and it's converted into an active form by what? This activated factor 7 and calcium and phospholipids that are released into the blood and tissue thromboplastin as well will activate, okay, prothrombin into thrombin. right here. Or actually, I'm sorry, this is a prothrombin activator. So prothrombin activator, right, is an enzyme that will work on prothrombin, converting it into thrombin. And what else do you need? Well, you need calcium and phospholipids right here. And thrombin is an enzyme that will then chop off a piece of fibrinogen and make it fibrin. All right, so, and what happens to thrombin when it converts fibrinogen to fibrin? Nothing. It can convert that reaction over and over and over again. So here is two levels of enzymatic reaction. So here's a cascade mechanism, and so that's a level of amplification every time. So a lot of fibrin can be built very rapidly in the body because all of these proteins are in high concentration, but what? In an inactive form, just in reserve in your blood, ready to go to work. All right, prothrombin needs vitamin K in order for it to be built by the liver. So it's dependent on vitamin K, and that is not built by your body since it's a vitamin. Where do you get vitamin K from? A dietary source, right, like all vitamins. So it's an essential nutrient that your body can't make. And people without vitamin K will have very poor clotting function. They will have a tendency to hemorrhage. So a really good question would be, what kind of diet gives you vitamin K? Where do you find vitamin K in your diet if you don't take a pill with it in there? Green leafy vegetables, all right? And a good example might be, for instance, like broccoli. And everybody in here probably loves broccoli, all right? There can't be a single person that doesn't love broccoli. And, you know, I could ask, does anybody not like broccoli in here? There's probably not a single person. There's a lot of people don't like broccoli in here. Okay, well, then maybe you should take a pill with a little vitamin K in there because your blood clotting function could be deficient as a result of that. And as a matter of fact, I know my little nephews, when they were real young, like 3-4 years old, they'd roughhouse all the time. And somebody would get hit in the nose, and guess what would happen? They would get a nosebleed because they would never eat vegetables of any kind, much less broccoli, right? And so I would sit them down when they'd have a nosebleed, and I would tell them about this extrinsic pathway and the common pathway and fibrin formation and how important it is for them to eat broccoli, especially broccoli, so they wouldn't get nosebleeds. And they came to me for sympathy because they had a nosebleed. And for some reason, it never really sunk into them how important it was, right? So I know you all are a little bit different than my nephews that were 3 or 4 years old. But now they eat a lot of broccoli and they horse around even stronger around the house, okay? And for instance, if you raise birds at home, sometimes you like to trim their feathers, right, so they don't fly away, and you can nick a blood vessel, and unless they have the proper diet, they can bleed to death very easily with just a little nick in a blood vessel in a feather. So you should feed them what to get help their clotting function? Broccoli, that's exactly right. Okay. That has some other important clinical ramifications for people, because some people are on anticoagulation therapy where their blood clotting function is reduced on purpose because their body, for whatever reason, is producing blood clots, right? And sometimes they're on Coumadin, which is Coumarin, or sometimes on heparin, usually not heparin long-term, but Coumarin. And that Coumarin has to be adjusted depending on what their diet is, because what might they be eating? Broccoli, which has vitamin K, which is going to adjust the speed and efficiency of their coagulation mechanism, and that's going to misadjust their Coumarin therapy. So they have to go in and get their Coumarin levels adjusted and their clotting function measured. And the best way to do that is to what? Just have a constant diet. If you're going to eat broccoli, that's fine. But what? Have a little bit every day. Don't have any 1 week and then a kilogram the next week, because your blood chemistry is going to be totally different, right? So diet does affect how your body operates. All right, so prothrombin gets converted to thrombin, an enzyme, and then that converts fibrin to fibrin, which forms a blood clot, and that process is what we call coagulation. It happens very rapidly because of this cascade mechanism, but you should also know some important molecules that make that happen, like what? Calcium, phospholipids from damaged membranes. The intrinsic pathway, okay, is important even in an individual, because when thrombin is formed, all right, it acts as an enzyme and it activates factor 11 right here. All right, and when factor 11 is activated, again, you've got to have calcium and phospholipids. Guess what the intrinsic pathway does? It activates prothrombin activator, right, which then makes more thrombin formation. All right, and then what does that do? That accelerates the intrinsic pathway, making more thrombin, which accelerates the intrinsic pathway that makes more thrombin. And so what kind of feedback mechanism is that? That's a positive feedback mechanism, but in order to have a proper blood clotting function, you need that positive feedback mechanism, and patients or people that don't have that positive feedback mechanism will not have proper fibrin formation or reduced blood clotting function. So there are some people that probably you've heard of, hemophiliacs, patients with hemophilia. They don't make this factor 8 right here, so they miss this positive feedback loop. And so they actually can die when they have even a small paper cut, for instance. They can bleed to death if not treated because they're missing this positive feedback mechanism right here. Yeah.
So how does it finally stop?
Okay, there are antagonistic controls, which are on the next couple of slides that we're going to look at. But that is something that's really important, right? Because if you have too much fibrin formation, let's just say you have a cut on your right hand, right, and then all of a sudden you start to get clots on your left hand, can you imagine what's going to happen? Well, you're going to die, right? Because the blood is going to stop flowing through various parts of your body, and you need to have blood flow in your brain and your heart, and that does happen to patients when they're really, really sick. That's called disseminated intravascular coagulopathy, okay, where you get blood clots forming all over your body. That's really a terrible situation, and it's usually fairly rare, but it happens, and it's really unfortunate when that happens because it's very difficult to treat. Okay, but if somebody has hypertension and a broken bone and diabetes and they've smoked cigarettes for 40 years, okay, and so when you get a situation like that, then that kind of situation can develop in people. Really difficult to treat. All right, so these are the three steps, but the bottom line is what? Fibrin formation right here. All right, so here is a list of all of the different factors. The factors have numbers, not by where they participate in these various pathways right here, but when they were discovered. So factor 1 was discovered first, and it might be way down in this list over here. All right, so that's how they got their numbers. So you should just be aware of these three basic steps, and you need calcium, phospholipids, and the bottom line right here is that it is fibrin formation which makes this net. So it is not an antibody-antigen reaction. Coagulation is fibrin formation. So now we're talking about dissolution of blood clots, which was your question right here. Okay, when the damage to a tissue is repaired, but this also helps contain the extent of clot formation, right? So if you cut your finger, you want a blood clot just over the wound in that one finger, not all the fingers of that hand or your hand or the arm or the other arm. It's due to these compounds that act antagonistically to the coagulation processes. Okay, so when a blood clot, when the tissue is repaired, okay, activated factor 12 right here causes activation of kallikrein. And kallikrein is an enzyme that converts plasminogen. Ooh, what can you tell me about plasminogen? You've never heard of it before, but you know a lot about it. Is it made all the time in your body? Absolutely. But is it active? No, because why? It's an ogen, okay? But when kallikrein is activated, that converts plasminogen into plasmin, and the job of plasmin is to break down fibrin, right? So that is the enzyme that digests fibrin, converts it into amino acids, right? Then, of course, you can recycle those amino acids. That dissolves the clot, that allows blood flow back through those particular blood vessels. So that's a really handy reaction for getting rid of that blood clot that's inside your body, but it also limits the extent of clot formation to the appropriate region when you need a clot, right? It prevents that clot from going all over your body. Do I have anything here on that? No. There's another thing. Tissue plasmin activator can also form, and sometimes, you know, we're using this clinically now, so if somebody has a blood clot in a certain part of their body, they can be given something called TPA, which is a plasmin activator, and that blood clot will dissolve. When might you want to give plasmin or a plasmin activator? Streptokinase is another enzyme that we get from bacteria that will dissolve blood clots. When might you want to give those substances to somebody? For instance, maybe when they have a clot that's in their brain that's causing a stroke, right? If you get to a hospital in time and they can diagnose what the problem is, right, we can give them a tissue plasmin activator right here, and the blood clot can dissolve, blood flow can be restored to the brain, and then it won't die as a result of that. They won't experience a stroke. All right, so that's really important, but you have to be living in a nice modern city like Los Angeles. So take a guess, what places could do something like that? Oh, like Memorial in Long Beach, right? Okay, big hospitals like that are good because they have to determine why somebody is having a stroke. And there's two reasons why. One, because maybe there's a plug, there's a thrombus in a blood vessel that's blocking blood flow. That's one reason. Another reason is maybe because a blood vessel like an aneurysm exploded, right? And now the blood vessel is leaking blood everywhere in the brain. So what would happen if you were to give plasmin to somebody that has a leaky blood vessel instead of a blood clot thinking that you're going to help them? What will you do to the bleeding? Make it worse, right? So that's why only certain hospitals can do this, because you have to have a definitive diagnosis before you'd institute any kind of therapy like that. Okay. Anticoagulants. Some people are on anticoagulant therapy. Some of these work in a test tube because we can't give them to people. But maybe we want to take blood from somebody and prevent it from clotting, keep it as a nice fluid. So we can put calcium chelators in the test tube, like sodium citrate or EDTA in the test tube to keep blood from clotting. But why can't we give EDTA to somebody that we want to decrease their clotting function? Maybe because they have some part of their body that is throwing clots, we want to decrease their clotting function. How come we can't give them sodium citrate or EDTA? A chelator is something that will bind to a molecule and cause it to precipitate, right, to come out of solution, thereby just like taking it right out of your body. So why can't we give EDTA to somebody? Because what does EDTA do? It depletes calcium. But you need calcium in your blood. Yeah, for what reason? More than just coagulation. Why do you need proper levels of calcium in your body? Calcium ions. Muscle contraction, synaptic transmission, it's a second messenger for many hormone systems, right? So you just can't deplete somebody of calcium because it's a necessary electrolyte. But in a test tube, that would be fine, who cares? Heparin is another molecule. It activates antithrombin 3, which blocks the formation of thrombin. And if thrombin isn't produced, what does not happen? Thrombin is necessary to convert fibrinogen into fibrin, so fibrin formation won't happen, so blood clot won't be established, right? So that decreases coagulation. And coumarin, right, blocks clotting by inhibiting the activation of vitamin K. And y'all need proper levels of vitamin K. And vitamin K works indirectly by reducing calcium availability for coagulation. All right, so those are some anticoagulants. All right, so now we're going to move from the blood and talk about the circulatory system in the heart. This is a pretty fascinating part of the class. But you got to know your anatomy. So since we're talking about the heart, I'll give you a quiz right now. Oh, and your heart just kind of sped up a little bit. But it's going to be a fun quiz because it's just an oral quiz, not for course points. The heart has chambers because it's going to squeeze down on blood. It's a pump. How many chambers does the heart have? Well, that's pretty quiet. So hopefully everybody said four, okay. And blood should flow in one direction through the heart. There are things inside the heart that make sure blood only goes in one direction. And what are those things called? Valves. How many valves does the heart have? Okay. And I should have that as a prerequisite for this class, to where you wouldn't even get an ad code, right? Because there are four valves in the heart, which means that over spring break, you're lucky you get to go back and study your anatomy, right? So there are four chambers. How many valves? Four. Two atrioventricular, two semilunar valves. All right? So go back, make sure you know that. Plus, you got to know something about the circulation. All right? So we'll take it from the top again. How many chambers does a heart have? Got to make sure you know them. How many valves does a heart have? And how many circulations does your circulatory system have? Very good. Okay, there are two. And what are they? The pulmonary and systemic circulations. And that's why the heart has how many sides? Two sides. There's a right side and a left side. Both sides has one atria, one ventricle. All right, so here is what you should just know from your anatomy. Make sure you can label all of these valves and chambers right here. And another interesting thing that you should be aware of is, what is a definition of an artery and what's a definition of a vein? What is an artery? I hear some good definitions. It's a blood vessel that takes blood away from the heart, which means a vein is a blood vessel that brings blood back to the heart, and a vein and an artery have nothing to do with the quality of blood that's moving. Whether it is high in oxygen or high in CO2 makes no difference as to whether that vessel is an artery or a vein. It's only the direction. Now, on this slide right here, which I'm not going to talk about, okay, but obviously I am a little bit, red right here signifies that the blood in this blood vessel is oxygenated, or it has relatively high oxygen, and blue vessels are relatively low in oxygen but relatively high in carbon dioxide. Okay, so here is a blood vessel that's blue. Okay, this one right here, is this an artery or a vein? And I hear vein because it's blue. But what's the definition of a vein? Has nothing to do whether it's red or blue, only what? The direction of blood flow. And what is the direction of blood flow here? This is away from the heart. So since it's away from the heart, this is an artery. Okay? So arteries can be either blue or red, which means that it has high oxygen, or low oxygen. They're still arteries if blood flow is away from the heart. Okay? Some arteries, all arteries in the pulmonary circulation are blue, meaning low in oxygen. It's blood, and these are arteries because it's going away from the heart, but where is it going? To the lungs to pick up oxygen, right? And so why would it go to the lungs if it was high in oxygen already? No reason, right? So the pulmonary circulation arteries are low in oxygen. The veins, is this a vein right here? How do you know? It's red colored. I'm confused. Unconfuse me. Why is this a vein? Because it's going back to the heart, and it's coming back to the heart from the lungs, and it picked up oxygen, so of course it's going to be red. It's what the other part of the pulmonary circulation, right? All right, what are the three major kinds of blood vessels you have? And you got to know their functions. You've got arteries, which do what? Take blood away from the heart. You got veins, which bring blood back to the heart. And what's the third kind of blood vessel? A capillary. Okay, which way does blood go there, to the heart or from the heart? It doesn't matter. The function is what? Exchange happens. Exchange can only happen in capillaries because, and you should know this from your anatomy, because why? Because capillaries are thin. They only have one layer, which is the endothelium. They don't have like that tunica media and externa and all those other things that are connective tissues and muscle tissues and elastic tissues. So diffusion can happen across only small distances, like blood vessels that are thin, blood vessels that only have an endothelium like a capillary. So if we have oxygen in this blood vessel right here, all right, and we keep this blood stationary right here, can that oxygen go anywhere? Where is the oxygen at right here? What blood vessel is this? You can trace it back. Oh, that's the aorta. That's a descending aorta. We have an aorta. We have blood in the aorta that's loaded with oxygen, and we stop the heart. That blood can't go anywhere. What happens to that oxygen in the aorta? It's stuck. It just stays there. It can't go anywhere because the aorta is not a capillary. It can only enter or leave what at a capillary. That's why the CPR guidelines were adjusted a little bit. In which sense? What's more important? When you breathe for somebody or chest compressions? Chest compressions, because breathing is not so important because all that blood in all these arteries is loaded with oxygen. The only thing you have to do is get that blood to the person by doing what? Chest compressions. Okay, breathing is still important, but not as important as just getting the blood around, because there's a huge reservoir in oxygen in all of these blood vessels. All right, so all of this has really important implications. All right, so here you see the two circulations. From the left side of the heart, it goes into the systemic circulation, and where does that go? All over your body. Think of like a stick man all over your body, right? It's a large area. The pulmonary circulation starts here with the pulmonary trunk, and where does it go? Only the lungs, right? So the pulmonary circulation is a lot smaller. It takes a lot less energy for blood to move through the pulmonary circulation compared to your whole body. So which ventricle has more work to do, the left or the right? The left has a lot more work to do, so it's hypertrophied. It's a lot bigger than the right ventricle over here. So typically we're going to find blood pressures in the systemic circulation of 120 over 80. Blood pressure in the pulmonary circulation is going to be about a quarter, even less than a quarter of that, maybe 25 over 12, something like that. Because it doesn't take a lot of pressure to get blood through the pulmonary circulation. You know, and you can see that when you did your dissections of the right ventricle here. All right, so that's too much talk about that. All right, so review your cardiac anatomy. Oh, here's an interesting point, the fibrous skeleton of the heart. All right, now let me look at the next slide. Okay, good. Now here you have, come on cursor, come on down over here. What layer of the heart is this right here? That's the myocardium, right? Epicardium is on the top, endocardium is on the inside. Okay, and remember something about cardiac muscle that makes this layer right here? What's something, tell me some things about skeletal muscle. Okay, cardiac muscle, right here, myocardium, cardiac muscle. What are some interesting things about cardiac muscle? It's striated, yeah. It acts like a syncytium, which means all of these myocardial cells become activated as a unit. Why is that? It has intercalated discs which have gap junctions in them, so sodium currents can go from one cell to another, or the diffusion of sodium from one cell to the other. Okay, what was the point I was making? Ah, okay, I know the point I was trying to make. Okay, also, all right, so you excite so these myocytes can conduct electrical impulses because of those gap junctions. There's a place in the heart where we don't have myocardial cells. We have the fibrous skeleton, and that's between the atria and the ventricles. And that is just connective tissue. And connective tissue does not have gap junctions. Connective tissue is not excitable like muscle tissue is. So that separates the atria from the ventricles in an electrical sense, right? So it is possible for the atria to work as both of these atria as one kind of heart and the ventricles to work as another kind of heart because they don't communicate with each other electrically because of that fibrous skeleton. All right, the fibrous skeleton is also important because that is the area where these valves are connected. All right, so it adds a very tough layer of tissue so that the valves are very stable, they don't move around, they don't change their shape, they're circular because of the fibrous skeleton separating the atria from the ventricles. Well, you might be asking, well, how is it that the heart works as a unit if the atria are electrically isolated from the ventricles? Because there's one little pathway that allows electrical information to go from the atria into the ventricles. All right, so we're going to look at that. All right, but I want you to know something about that fibrous skeleton, okay? It forms rings, the annular fibrosity that holds the valves in place. It allows for special communication or coordination of the heart because we want the atria to contract first and then the ventricles a little time after that. So that's the importance of the fibrous skeleton right here, okay? And let's see. Okay, here is, I do want you to appreciate this. All right, so how many chambers does the heart have? How many valves does the heart have? And how many circulations?
Two.
Okay, because there's a right side and left side. So here is, I'm going to erase this, I'm erasing this right here. What process am I erasing? Am I erasing coagulation? No. What am I erasing? Agglutination. Okay, so don't forget where antigens are located and antibodies are located, all that kind of stuff. All right, so the heart is actually two pumps back to back. There's one on the left, one on the right. So here is one pump. We're going to call this the left ventricle, or LV. Where does the left ventricle pump blood?
to the systemic circulation. Okay, and after the circulation, where does his blood go? It goes back to the, okay, oh, got to review your anatomy. Come on, I need some help here. This is the systemic circulation. This is the right atrium right here, and the right atrium then pumps blood into the right ventricle. Okay, so I'm going to kind of put these together in one box. And then the right ventricle pumps blood to where? As a matter of fact, you know what? I didn't want to do this, but I think I have to do this. I got to come up over here. To where? The pulmonary circulation. Okay, and then after the pulmonary circulation, where does it go? Okay, back to the left atrium / left ventricle, and it pumps that into the systemic circulation. So blood is flowing around in a circle all over the place, right? And so there are really two pumps. There's the left pump and the right pump in order for blood to flow in this circuit right here. All right, so the question I have right here is what can you tell me about the blood flow in the systemic circulation compared to the pulmonary circulation? Can they be different or should they be the same? Okay, so let's just say we stop the circulation through the pulmonary circulation. All right, so let's block it completely. What happens to the systemic circulation? Well, it crashes because it doesn't have any blood to pump. Okay, so over a long period of time, or maybe, you know, like minutes or so, the rate of blood flow through the pulmonary circulation has to equal the systemic circulation. Otherwise, blood is going to build up someplace, right? And then a blood vessel is going to explode and make a big mess. So the circulation through the pulmonary and systemic have to be equal over some reasonably short period of time. All right, so rate of flow through the systemic must equal the rate of flow through the pulmonary circulation. Otherwise, something's going to blow up. Okay, and maybe you can see it from that diagram a little bit better than on this PowerPoint slide right here. So here we see the fibrous skeleton and all the valves in position. This slide just says that the left ventricle has a lot harder job to do because the systemic circulation is almost 10 times longer than the pulmonary circulation, and so it's 3 or 4 times thicker. Okay, heart valves. Make sure you know your heart valves, right? So you got 2 semilunar. Where do you find these semilunar valves right here? At the root of the aorta and the root of the pulmonary trunk. And where do you find the bicuspid and tricuspid? Between the atria and ventricle, so they're atrioventricular valves. And if you're going to buy a car, what would you do? Try before you buy, okay, for just naming those atrioventricular valves. And what's another name for a bicuspid valve? Mitral valve. People use bicuspid and mitral valve interchangeably, sometimes in the same sentence. So make sure you know that they're talking about the same valve. Okay. All right, so semilunar valves, cardiac cycle. Now this is new material, okay, compared to anatomy. The heart is not like an electric pump or electric motor that is pumping all the time. Okay, not like the engine in your car. Sometimes it's pumping blood, other times it's not pumping blood. And it's pumping blood when what? The muscle contracts, and then the muscle has to relax, and when the heart muscle relaxes, it's not pumping blood, but there is something important happening during that time. Okay, when the heart is not contracting, what is a really important thing that is happening? It is filling with blood. So blood is going back, filling up the chambers inside the heart so that when it does contract, it is actually pumping blood and not just contracting futilely. Okay, so the heart has 2 phases. The contraction phase is what we call systole, and the relaxation phase is what we call diastole, and they just follow each other. And it just so happens that the atria contract simultaneously, and when the atria contract, those are the superior chambers, they pump blood past the atrioventricular valves into the ventricles, and then when the ventricles are filled with blood, then they contract about 200 milliseconds later. Normal blood pressure in the systemic circulation is 120/80, right? And normal pulmonary pressure is about 25 over 10. So it's a lot less. And so why do you need less pressure in the pulmonary circulation compared to the systemic? Because it's a smaller circulation, right? Okay, so that's kind of the cardiac cycle. Some definitions before we look at some diagrams. I got to check Blackboard. There's a very important figure called a Wiggers diagram. Did anybody download a Wiggers diagram from Blackboard? I hope I have it in there. If not, I got to make sure it's in there. I'll show you what that's like in a second. What is a Wiggers diagram? This is a Wiggers diagram right here. The one that I like is the one that's in your lab manual. Okay, and that is the one that is an exam figure, and I don't have it as a PowerPoint slide, but this will suffice. All right, so make sure over spring break you start to look at that Wiggers diagram and be able to fill in all the proper letters with the little lines. And maybe we can, we're not going to have much time to talk about it today. Too bad. All right, so let's define some of these things. End diastolic volume. This is the volume of a chamber of the heart. At what period of time? At the end of diastole, but what does that mean? That's at relaxation. So what is that like? Is that a small volume inside the heart or a large volume? End diastolic volume is large because that's after the period of time when the heart fills up with blood. So end diastolic volume is the largest volume inside the heart. And systolic volume, let's skip over stroke volume for a second. And systolic volume is what, a large volume or a small one? It's a small because that's when the heart is contracting, and it's at the end of systole, that's the smallest volume inside a chamber inside the heart. And stroke volume is basically just the difference between those two. So you take the end diastolic volume and subtract the end systolic volume, and the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart from its largest volume to the smallest, that is what we call the stroke volume, and that's just measured in milliliters. So it's the amount of blood that is what ejected from the ventricles during systole. Not all of the blood that is that fills the chambers of the heart is ejected during systole. There's always some left over inside the heart. Okay, so you should be able to answer these questions. What's larger, ESV or EDV? And is EDV. Right. What is stroke volume? You can do this calculation. If ESV is 20 and EDV is 80, then you should be able to calculate what the stroke volume is. Okay. As the ventricles, you know, I'm not going to look at this right now. I'm going to give you a little orientation to this diagram. So this diagram right here has two important heart phases. What are two important heart phases? Systole or what's another name for systole? Contraction and diastole, okay, that's relaxation. And we're going to plot a number of physiologic parameters as we proceed through systole and diastole. So what are you going to look at over break? You're going to look at blood pressure, you're going to look at volumes, and this right here is electrical activity as measured from the surface of your body, and that's called the electrocardiogram. So we put electrodes on the surface of somebody, or maybe put subcutaneous needles in their subcutaneous space. Anybody volunteer for that electrode in lab? The subcutaneous, the needle electrodes? No? Okay, and here is noise that your heart makes when it's going into systole or diastole. So these are heart sounds. And these are all justified in time in the correct space. All right, so we have pressure in the ventricles that goes from 0 during diastole to 120 when the ventricles contract maximally. All right, and then when the ventricles relax, what happens? The pressure goes back down to 0. It doesn't stay there because what happens? Well, hopefully the heart contracts again, right? And it goes back up to 120. All right, so that's in a ventricle. Here is a blood pressure trace that is not in the ventricle but in the aorta. Okay, when the heart contracts, it ejects blood into the aorta, so the pressure increases to 120, and then during diastole, what happens to the pressure in the aorta? It starts to die away, but it never goes to zero because there's resistance in blood vessels, and fortunately, the heart beats again, and it shoots back up to 120. It usually gets down to about 80, at least in a healthy person. All right, so this is the diastolic pressure, here's systolic. So when you get your blood pressure measured, you get two numbers. You get the systolic pressure over the diastolic. In which circulation is that? If it's 120 over 80, what circulation is that? The systemic circulation. And no one has ever been given a number of what their pulmonary pressures are in here, I would guess. Right? That's difficult to measure. Where would you have to measure pulmonary pressures? Deep inside your thoracic cavity. That's a really difficult number to get at. But pulmonary hypertension is just as important as systemic hypertension, just we don't really know a whole heck of a lot about it routinely, unfortunately. Okay, and then here are volumes of the chambers inside the heart, mostly ventricular volume. So we're going to start talking about this Wiggers diagram when we come back next time. But it will be on the test. Okay? Okay. So don't be blindsided. Don't come in on Tuesday after spring break and not have looked at this diagram. That would be bad. The test is Thursday after spring break. And the sign-in sheet, I think, is going around someplace. Wave the sign-in sheet if you have it. Who's got? Oh, good, 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 good.
Okay. Did you sign the sign-in sheet?